Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The word Latino conjures hot-button issues like immigration, language, identity, issues that aren't going away. One in three Americans is expected to be Latino by the year 2050. A new Norton anthology pulls together the written expression of our fastest-growing minority, from 16th-century priests and conquistadors to today's fiction superstars like Junot Diaz. This hour on Point, we're reading the Latino literary canon. You can join the conversation. Is this your voice? Jose Marti, Julia Alvarez, Christina Garcia, William Carlos Williams. Beyond language itself and maybe blood, what makes Latino literature Latino? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now in the studio is Ilan Stabanz. He is an award-winning essayist, columnist, and cultural commentator, professor of Latin American and Latino culture at Amherst College, Mexican-American, biographer of Colombia's Gabriel García Márquez, and now general editor of the new Norton Anthology of Latino Literature. It took 13 years to complete and spans five centuries of Latino writing. Ilan Stabanz, welcome to On Point. It's great to have you.
My pleasure to be here.
Wow. Now, okay, I read a lot. This one, 2,500 pages. I cannot say that I got to every page of this one, but every place that I opened it and dug in, and I did it a lot, it's really remarkable. I mean, the history here, just for starters, you get a very particular and a very deep sense of the Americas before we even come to what we call America. History breathes in all of this, I guess, as in all literature, but it wakes general readers up, I think, to read it American history from this Latino perspective.
Well, thank you again for having me. I'm delighted to be here, and I'm delighted to have this massive, monstrous but happy book in my hands and in the hands of readers. It has taken, as you said, 13 years to make it come alive. I have a 14-year-old child, so I know what...
Almost the same birthday.
You hit the nail right on the head. It is about plurality, about the Americas, about the many different Latinos that we are. This concept of Latinidad, of Latinoness, is a sum of parts. We come from different parts of the Spanish-speaking world, from the very many different countries that constitute Latin America and the Spanish-speaking Caribbean. We also come from Spain, and we come from the past. We come from the present, and we come also from the future. A fast-growing, almost 50 million population that has not been silent at any point, has been recording, writing, delivering its word on the written page, in pulpits, in churches, and on radio, in newspapers. And the attempt of this book is to bring together some of the most representative samples of that troubled, complex, labyrinthine history, and to allow readers to understand that we are an essential component of this country, in that there is no America without Latinos, in that Latinos make an essential part of the mosaic, of the texture of this country.
When you throw your net over Latino literature, what's in there and what's not? How do you define? What are the boundaries of this body of literature? What's Latino mean to you? What's Latino literature mean?
Well, we have defined the term Latino as a person who lives currently in the United States, who has roots here, but who might have been an immigrant or might have been born here for one generation, two generations, five, six. The United States, as it's currently defined geographically, has not always been like that. And so Latinos have been in other parts of the country and have been in those parts longer than many of the citizens of the United States that come from other ethnic groups.
But when you go back in history, the net goes beyond those boundaries. When you go back to the earliest days, you've got conquistadors, you've got priests, we'll hear from one in a moment, from the Caribbean. But there's a line somewhere. You don't go to you're Gabriel Garcia Marquez. You don't go to South America.
No, we do. We stay in the United States, and the United States is what we are interested in. The United States as a country, and as a country that has had the Latino experience. We are not including Latin Americans. We are not including Caribbeans that live in the Caribbean today. We are including in this anthology the Latinos that live and are part of this country.
And a few from outside. I mean, there's a reading from a priest here who's in what was then Hispaniola, now the Dominican Republic and Haiti. So early on, maybe a little more flexibility before things began to gel. You describe one persistent theme in Latino literature as the search for wholeness. You alluded to that. But what do you mean by that?
Well, for some of us, the being Latino in the United States might mean to be a Puerto Rican in the mainland. For others, it might be to be a Cuban American, but not necessarily a Latino American. Some of us define ourselves according to our national background. And what I'm trying to get at in this anthology, and together with me, the fabulous team of scholars that worked intensely for all these years to bring the best and the clearest to the reader, is that we might be having parallel lines or parallel rivers, but that at some point those rivers come together in a large ocean, and the Puerto Rican and Dominican and Colombian and Argentine and Mexican all become one major group. And
is that the goal, the necessary endpoint, or not?
I don't know if it's the necessary endpoint. Everybody, the 50 million almost, will have different opinions, and that's what we want in a country like this. But there is something that unites us. It might be history, it might be cuisine, it might be language. And just because we have those bridges are there to be explored, to be crossed. We might return to the place of origin. We might stay on the other side of the bridge. But this sum of parts is essential to understanding what Latinos are in the United States. We don't all come from the same country. We all not eat the same food or dream the same dreams or dance to the same music. There is a plurality, a multiplicity of ways of being.
There is beauty in this literature. There are dreams in this literature. There's history. There is some very difficult history. I was struck right off the bat. The very first entry in the book comes from a priest, the first, I guess, priest ordained in this hemisphere back in the 1500-something. I wish you'd tell us a little bit about him and read just a bit from what he's written here. I was just mute after reading this.
Fray Bartolomé de las Casas might well be the Che Guevara of his time, a man who spent his days and his words trying to indict the poor, reckless behavior of Spaniards in this part of the world as part of the conquest and colonization. He wrote a history of the Spanish experience of colonization that was designed to confront the Spanish king and queen and those in Spain to the reality of devastation that had taken place here. It is called A Brief History of the Conquest of the Americas.
And we're talking very early on. This is just after 1492. He was Spanish. He came as a young man, not a priest yet, had a piece of land and Indian slaves himself, became a priest, wrote about how the original Native Americans there were this wonderful people, and there were so many of them. And then he goes on to describe what happened.
And he says, "Yet into this sheepfold, into this land of meek outcasts, there came some Spaniards who immediately behaved like ravening wild beasts, wolves, tigers, or lions that had been starved for many days. And Spaniards have behaved in no other way during the past 40 years down to the present time, for they are still acting like ravening beasts, killing, terrorizing, afflicting, torturing, and destroying the native peoples, doing all this with the strangest and most varied new methods of cruelty never seen or heard of before, and to such a degree that this island of Hispaniola, once so popular, having a population that I estimated to be more than 3 million, has now a population of barely 200 persons.
It is a shocking report. If it were a kind of a UN human rights report today, it would burn your hair off. And here it is in 15, I don't know, 20-something.
Bartolomé de las Casas is known for having promoted the so-called leyenda negra, or black legend. That is, that the conquest of the Americas, of the Indies, as they were called at that time, was not a rosy affair, and instead was marked by violence, by blood, and by devastation.
It was used against the Spanish Empire, this legend, but there was a painful amount of truth in it.
Absolutely. And here we have a beautiful example of what literature can be used for: to denounce, to describe, to use the word in order to understand the complexity of a reality that at first sight might be seen in one way, but when we go deeper, it is far more complex.
North Americans can hardly throw stones here. I mean, the Indian Native American population in the North American continent suffered its own devastation, but there's a pain that lies in a lot of this Latino literature here, as well as joy and beauty.
And in the Fray Bartolomé, a Spaniard, he identifies with the natives and becomes a spokesperson because he knows the natives do not have that channel of communication. They cannot use the pen in order to denounce. This is very important because for a long period of time we have wondered who writes and about whom. And in this case, this is a priest that assumes the voice of this voiceless in order to be able to convey the destruction, the violence that took place. And the writer often usurps somebody else's identity, somebody else's personality, in order to make us see what that person inside is all about.
Interesting, complex history here. This friar himself from a converso family, Jews who had become Christian. Here he is in the New World, part of this amazing range of Latino literature. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking this hour about Latino lit from the dawn of American settlement until right now, the voice of the literature of America's fastest growing minority. Ilan Stabanz is with us. He's general editor of the big new Norton Anthology of Latino Literature. 13 years in the making, 2,000 plus pages in the product, and of course, centuries really, because it is centuries of Latino writing in this hemisphere and largely in the United States that it contains. Give us a sense of the range of what you're presenting here. You break it into kind of periods. You've got to break it up somehow. Give us a sense of those, this sort of big mountain range of Latino lit.
Well, there are close to 200 and 10 different authors in the anthology. They come from very many different countries of origin. The anthology is divided into six parts. It begins with a period of a colonization. It progresses to periods of annexation and assimilation. One of the most interesting sections for me is the period of upheaval from the 1940s to the 1970s, when the civil rights era incorporated Latinos, mostly Mexican Americans and Puerto Ricans, in different modes and modalities.
So you mean upheaval in this country,
in
within
this
the
country,
Latino community,
absolutely.
Sort
the
of Chicano political
movement.
Awareness and standing
yes,
up.
Cesar Chavez, the Puerto Rican young lords, and so on. And then we have probably the longest section in the anthology, called Into the Mainstream, from the 1980s to the present, a whole orchestra or a whole symphony of voices that has become in many ways part of the mainstream and has been read widely. Juno Diaz, Julia Alvarez, Cristina Garcia, some of the ones that you mentioned, but some of the predecessors as well. And the last part of the anthology, one that I have, that I hold here to my heart, it has to do with the more popular manifestations. We include music, rock, ballads, folk songs, children's songs. We also include
Ricky
cartoons.
Martin's in here, Living the Vida Loca.
cartoons and all sorts of itinerant theater. And then at the very end of the anthology, there is a sample of Latin American essayists who have looked at the United States and at the Latino experience in the United States and have reflected on it. Those essays are translated from Spanish into English.
You know, there have been Norton anthologies out for some time. And of course, there's the old old original, and it is not all white, but it is heavily white. If you sat, if you had the patience and the energy and the curiosity to sit and read that cover to cover, and then you read this, Norton Anthology of Latino Literature, cover to cover, what are the two profiles? We're talking very big, but you think big, that you would see here. What's the difference between these two cultures represented in these two great volumes?
Well, the difference to begin with is that in the previous Northern anthologies, we were hardly represented. We didn't have a place in the canon. We were marginalized for a variety of reasons. And the fact that this anthology exists today is a statement, a testament, a way of saying we are here. Our voice can no longer be ignored.
We get that. It wasn't there by absence. We know well. That's history that we're aware of, but I put it in positive terms, not what's not there, but what is in these two volumes and the differences that would emerge from these great writers over so much time. It's an impossible task I'm giving you, but what the heck?
Well, I would respond to your question.
What's the difference in these cultures?
Between looking at the United States in the 1920s and 30s and looking at the United States today, what is the difference between these two countries? The basis is the same. The idea of America is the same, but there is a dramatic transformation that has to do with immigrants that have come not from Europe anymore, but from the so-called third world. Immigrants that have come with a language that is other than this traditional European or old continent once, and that now have incorporated themselves into this experiment that is the United States. One of the features that I'm most attracted to, mm-hmm. and that I adore in the anthology, is how the language changes. At the very beginning, we have texts that were in Spanish and are translated into English. Then, at some point in the early 20s, Latinos embrace the English language and start writing in it. And at that point, one could say that it could enter already that other anthology that you're
absolutely.
Talking about. But then we become ambivalent, or the country becomes ambivalent about us, and that is expressed in our language. We go back and forth between Spanish and English. Our poems, our essays, our novels are in Spanglish, sometimes written mm-hmm. in Spanglish, sometimes thought in Spanglish and written in one language or the other.
Is there a difference in the ideals or the dreams between the covers of these two volumes?
I don't think there's a difference between the ideals and the dreams. We have the dreams of this country. The ideals and the dreams are to be integrated, to be plural, and to be multifaceted. I think that the main difference might be in the earlier Norton anthologies that had to do less with incorporation of varied voices, mm-hmm. marginal voices, mm-hmm. and more with the mainstream. This is a new tradition, but it's not a ghetto tradition. It is a tradition that is nurtured from all sorts of tributaries, and that is essential to understanding the United States today.
We're going to hear in just a moment from one of those in this great new anthology. Cristina Garcia will be with us. We can't wait. She wrote Dreaming in Cuban. Her new book is The Lady Matador's Hotel. But you've got a little bit here to read from Jose Marti, Two Homelands. This is a poem. Goes back to the late 19th century. Introduce us to him for people who may not know. And tell us what to listen for here.
José Martí is considered one of the main political figures of the Cuban movement for independence at the end of the 19th century in the Spanish-American War. He died shortly before, and yet he was the trigger in many ways at the level of the intellect of how to understand the independence of Cuba. When Fidel Castro came to power in 1958, he quickly adopted José Martí as one of the father figures of the new revolution and as a key element to understand his own regime.
And how does he make it into this?
Well, that is the
volume.
Key. We are in many ways kidnapping or taking him back and saying José Martí spent a number of important years of his life in the United States. Mm-hmm. He met Walt Whitman. He participated in some of the movements of this country, and he is as much a North American Latino as he is a Cuban from Cuba. This is a poem, Dos Patrias in Spanish, Two Homelands mm-hmm. in English, in which he reflects on being an exile, and it's a beautiful poem made of similes. I have two homelands, Cuba and the night, or are they one and the same? No sooner does His Majesty the Sun retire than Cuba, with long veils and a carnation in hand, silently, like a sad widow, appears before me. I know that bleeding carnation trembling in her hand. It's empty, My chest is destroyed and empty where the heart once was. It's time to begin dying. The night is the right time to say goodbye. The light is bothersome, and so are human words. The universe speaks better than man. Like a flag inviting us to battle, the candle's red flame flickers. Too full of myself, I open the windows. Silent, plucking the carnation's leaves, like a cloud darkening in the sky, Cuba, like a widow, passes by.
To homeland, Dos Patrias from José Martí. His two homelands are both Cuba. But you have many in this book who are immigrants and who are writing the experience of the sensation of two homelands at some point in their lives. Their or their family's country of origin and then the United States of America.
Ambivalence, the search for roots, the desire to understand what impact does the past have on us and what impact can we have on the present. This dwelling with two homelands, with many homelands, is very much a theme in Latino literature. Where do we stand? How do we connect to Mexico or Argentina? And what part of that Mexico is in us as we become full-fledged Americans? That is crucial.
Ilan Stabanz is general editor of the new Norton Anthology of Latino Literature. Ruggiero is calling from New York. Canton, New York. Ruggiero, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. I would like to hear from your guest his opinion about how the term Latino came to be used synonymous with Hispanic, being that they mean two different things, that are many Latin peoples in the world, including the Italians and French, which are members of the Latin Union. So I was curious when that terminology started being used as interchangeably, Hispanic and Latino.
Thanks, Ruggiero. Ilan?
It's a wonderful and a wonderfully pertinent question. At some point, we ponder the idea of maybe calling this the Norton Anthology of Hispanic Literature. But Latino is a term that feels closer to the community and that
the U.S.
The U.S.
community,
Spanish speaking,
as opposed to all the Western Hemisphere,
yes.
Or even the.
And let me tell you, maybe in order to explain that and to satisfy the curiosity of the reader, how this came to be. We Latinos in the United States have been called in a variety of ways across time. We were Latins, we were Spanish-speaking people, we were Spanish people, we were Hispanos, Hispanics, Latinos, Latin Americans. Depending on the time and place, one term would come to the fore, the others would recede. In the 1980s, for the first time, the U.S. Census Bureau adopted one of these terms, Hispanic, and as such, the community began to be described. For many, the term Hispanic felt alien, and it felt also coming from above, from the government. If the government was calling us Hispanics, we were not Hispanics. And it was also because it was describing a particular way of looking at the Spanish-American, Latin American experience. The community felt closer to the term Latino. It is gender-based, so you can have Latino and Latina, and that poses all sorts of complications. But, it might be of interest also. In the 1990s, I edited an anthology called Growing Up Latino. The original name was going to be Growing Up Hispanic. Several writers said they would never participate in a book with the term Hispanic. They proposed Latino. Others said if it was Latino, it should be Latino and Latina, and yet others suggested that it should be Mestizo. So we thought maybe Growing Up Hispanic, Mestizo, Mestiza, Latino, Latina, and fill in the blank.
The search for wholeness,
that's
indeed.
Right. But the editor wisely said, no, let me decide or help you decide. And we chose Latino and are happy about that. I think Latino is a term really that reflects that complexity.
You've got to come down somewhere, even as all that complexity is very evident in these pages. We are really honored to have with us right now from Austin, Texas, Christina Garcia. Prize-winning Cuban-American novelist. Her first big novel was Dreaming in Cuban, nominated for a National Book Award. Her latest, just out this month, is The Lady Matador's Hotel. Christina Garcia in Austin, thank you so much for being with us today.
Gentlemen, how are you?
Well, great.
Hello.
Thanks for being here.
Oh, my pleasure.
What makes Latino literature Latino?
Oh, well, I think I've been listening in for the last 20 minutes or so, and I think Ilan has been addressing this question brilliantly. I think Latinos are part of a grandly diverse, complex societies with multiple allegiances and also multiply hyphenated identities. New lexicons are continually born among them, and identities negotiated, and alternate realities built. And there is really no one Latino or Latina any more than there is one American.
Are you comfortable living under that rubric? Are you a Latino?
Latina, yeah. Right. Yeah, I would consider myself a very happy mongrel, really.
It's funny, you bring that up because that is a theme that comes up again and again here, the sort of mixing, more in Latin America than in the old colonies here, the mixing of races who met on this continent. It emerges, Cristina Garcia, as a real important theme in your work, not least in your family, but in so much of what's between the covers of this big anthology.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think I'm so glad Ilan has been talking about fracturing this notion of a monolithic Latinidad, because we are made up of all these disparate parts. And when I'm talking about this multiple hyphenation, I begin with my own daughter, who's Cuban, Guatemalan, Japanese, Russian, Jewish, and she participates in all aspects of those cultures, and yet she's a Latina too. This question of who is or who isn't gets in more and more complex and rich and kind of embracing of many, many identities and ways of being in America.
Cristina, stand by. You're there in Texas right now doing some work at the Michener Center for Writers at the University of Texas in Austin. We've got a question about the Texan experience here from Robert in Matthias, West Virginia. Robert, hi, you're on the air.
Fine, thank you. My question is a little bit related to what your previous caller was talking about.
Yes, sir.
And also the confrontation, that is, the people. Now, of course, as a political matter, it's very much the question of immigrants from Mexico into the United States. But at one point, there were portions of what's now the United States that were part of Mexico, and they were confronted with the arrival of large numbers of Anglos or Americans. Eventually, those Americans or Anglos who arrived in Texas banded together and in a revolution against Mexico, obtained the independence of the Republic of Texas.
Robert, we're coming right up to a break, but if you forgive me, let me pick it up right there, because you raised something that Ilan Stavins points out again and again. For many Latinos, many came to the United States, but for many others, the United States came to them in Texas and elsewhere.
Indeed, and what the caller is talking about is the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo in 1848, when two-thirds of Mexican territory became a part of this country in a sale that amounted to $50 million. And as a result, not only the land, but the dwellers of those lands, roughly 200,000 people that were living in those territories, became North Americans, became U.S. dwellers, did not become full-fledged Americans because their rights were not validated from that very first moment. But it is crucial to realize that not always do we come here by foot. The country has come also to us in the Caribbean, in Latin America, through invasion, through conquest, that not the Spaniards, but the United States has engaged in.
I'm Tom Ashby. Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Latino lit from the dawn of American settlement until right now. Ilan Stabenz is with us. He's general editor of the big new Norton Anthology of Latino Literature. Covers centuries from conquistadors and priests right up to extremely contemporary voices of American literature today, Latino voices in that American literature. And with us today from Austin, Texas, Christina Garcia, author of Dreaming in Cuban, and most recently, the latest, new one, The Lady Matador's Hotel. Great to have her with us. Ilan, we've gone way back to the 16th century. We've gone back a ways. Let's get something more contemporary here. You've got a reading from Julia Alvarez.
Julia Alvarez is a Dominican-American who teaches and lives in Middlebury, Vermont, and is the author of a number of significant novels, including How the Garcia Girls Lost Their Accent. Mm-hmm. This little essay that I am going to excerpt here is called Entre Lucas y Juan Mejía. She read it in 1992 to celebrate the Columbus Day centennial at that time, and it goes like this, just a few paragraphs. Mm-hmm. There's an expression in the Dominican Republic hard to translate into English. If you ask a Dominican how he is and he doesn't have a simple answer to give you, he might say, entre Lucas y Juan Mejía, if he's doing well. Or if he's doing poorly, entre Lucas y Juan Mejía. Let's go back to what that means. What does it actually mean, entre Lucas y Juan Mejía? Between the devil and the deep blue sea isn't right, because you're not describing the sensation of being cut between a pair of bad alternatives, a rock and a hard place. No. So-so isn't the meaning either, because the Dominican expression isn't at all to suggest bland stasis, mediocrity. It's much more intriguing than that. How are you doing? And between Lucas and Juan Mejía. But who are these guys? Well, who knows? The very story that inspired the saying is gone. So, of course, what happens is you have to go and tell the tale of why you feel the way you do. What are the forces you're caught between? How did you get there? And how does it feel to be there? For me, that moment of crisis, that being in the middle, is always the nexus of a story.
Being in the middle, reading there from Julia Alvarez. Christina Garcia, that being in the middle, you're Cuban-American. Is it central to your work?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, one of the editors of this wonderful anthology, Gustavo Perez Firmat, who did the Cuban section, had a book called Living on the Hyphen, if I'm remembering the title correctly. And I think that describes a lot of people's experience. Except now it's not necessarily just one hyphen, but, you know, more than one hyphen. And trying to find commonality is the challenge, and I think this anthology kind of explodes the notion of what constitutes literary and cultural production here in the U.S. I mean, when you think about it, what does, say, a third-generation Chicano artist in Chicago have in common with, say, a newly arrived Peruvian immigrant to South Central L.A., or what do the rituals and language of Tex-Mex culture have to do with concerns of Cuban or Nicaraguan exiles?
But are you saying they have nothing in common? I mean, we all have something in common.
This is the amazing thing, that people are always, you know, in my sense and in my growing up, trying to simplify something that's extraordinarily and richly complex. You know, that yes, I do have everything to do with, you know, suburban Puerto Ricans in Connecticut and the newcomers from Mexico and Central America, and the son of my Italian-Dominican son of my writer friend Angie Cruz. We're all connected, but, you know, we're not so easily categorizable. And I think, in general, people want to simplify things. They want to compartmentalize. And they don't want to deal with the complexity that is the Latino-Latina experience in the U.S.
Well, that's surely part of that desire for a monolith instead of complexity is part of both the welcome and the unease this country has felt when it comes to the whole Latino experience. Complexity comes with it. It's right in the grain of it, Ilan.
In the anthology, showcases many entries that are about that frustration, that feeling of being denigrated, that feeling of not being here, the confrontation.
Or diminished, flattened.
The sense that you are not worthy enough, that you are not quite human, that you haven't made it even though you're here. And I think that that part of the experience is in the written word as important as the one that celebrates the plurality and the multiplicity of being Latino.
Let's get a call from Monica in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Monica, you're on the air.
Hi. Hi, everybody. Hi. So I'm from Puerto Rico, and I've been here in the U.S. for 4 years now. I work both as a science writer and a medical interpreter. And I it's funny that you talk about being in the middle, because that's exactly what a medical interpreter, I think,
yeah.
does. What I find very fascinating in my work is how Latino patients are as patients because of their origin. For instance, there's a particular way of communicating their feelings and of communicating illness, and it is almost invariably through narration. It's like a storytelling that uses very rich, almost mythic language, I would say. So, for example, a doctor can be asking a patient what their symptoms are, and they say, you know, something like this pain that has befallen me, or my entire brain weighs on me. You know, you can almost translate things like that if you translate them literally. And it's almost poetic. And I don't think it's something that healthcare providers really have time for or understand. But it all comes from part of the stories that we hear and the legends and the language that. Idiosyncrasies that we are surrounded with when we grow up.
Monica, that's fantastic. How do the doctors respond to these mythic descriptions of headaches and bodily pains?
At the beginning, I was kind of interpreting sometimes because I thought it was essential. I was translating almost literally some of those things. And of course, they laugh, and there's always a smirk on their faces because it's not something that I think they get. So lately I just, kind of strip away the narration from this very rich language and just try to find a commonality between them. But I think it kind of tells to how important it could be to appreciate this kind of Latino, experience through literature, because
yeah.
you can, if you gain that appreciation, I guess you can, it can even help you in things as basic as this interaction.
Monica, that is a great story, a great capturing there. Those doctors are missing out on a lot of poetry when you don't give them that. Christina, do you recognize what's being described there?
Oh, and, absolutely. Absolutely.
But does that does that happen when language comes into English? This is all in English. It's not in Spanish.
Yes, it is all in English. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, part of the challenge.
Much of it translated.
A writer who writes in English, but who writes books, a large part of which are taking place in Spanish, I also feel like that translator. And it's incumbent upon me to have English adapt, absorb, and reflect some of the rhythm and syncopation and some of the, you know, mythic qualities, as Monica from Cambridge was describing, into English. It's a way of making English cha-cha-cha a little bit, you know?
I guess here's a web comment from a Hispanagencia. She says, hearing Dos Patrias, which we heard earlier, Jose Marti, Two Homelands. Hearing Dos Patrias on NPR was, even in translation, moving. Thank you. Ilan Stavins, there's a lot of translation that's going on.
Let me say that I believe that all writers, even when monolingual, are translators. The act of translating an image to the written word is an effort that takes much talent. But a writer that deals with two languages or more, and a writer that lives in an environment where two languages clash, has to use the tools of translation constantly. And we Latinos are about translation. In between us is a life in translation, sometimes without an original. We feel that we live in Spanish and are not fully comfortable that we live in English and not comfortable either, or in Spanglish, that there is something lost. And that is what literature is about, the feeling that there is something lost in the effort to tell a part of the world that has not been spoken of enough.
To bring experience to the page. Maybe related to this, Christina, Monica was wonderfully talking about how as a medical interpreter, her Latino patients will bring the mythic into their descriptions of what's going on. One thing many people will associate with Latino literature, right or wrong, but is magical realism. Gabriel Garcia Marquez uses it famously. You have used it. Is there something unique to this, to these cultures, or this overarching umbrella that makes that, that gives magnetism, that makes magical realism magnetic? Are you drawn to it because you're a Latino writer, Christina?
Well, I think definitely it's part of the tradition and part of the, you know, sense of liberty one feels when telling a story is to exaggerate it festively. but I would not say,
Hawthorne, not Melville, not exactly. On the other hand, the Great White Whale, I guess that is magical realism.
I think Moby Dick is one of the great novels of all time.
Yeah, you're right.
I mean, when I read The Metamorphosis, I felt it was...
Yes,
you know,
Kafka,
could have come
okay.
out of my family,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
I mean, so it's not only specific to the Latino or even Latin American experience. It's actually worldwide. This magical realism surfaces in all cultures, in all literary traditions. But it's become, I think, renowned and associated with Latin American and Latino and Latina literature because it's, you know, so much at the has been so much at the forefront of the Latino Latin American literary boom from the 60s,
yeah,
and in all the literature produced since. So,
Ilana, our time grows short. There's a couple more things I'd love to hear. One is, you don't just have sort of high literature. There is, as you say, comics. There's pop song lyrics. Living the La Vida Loca is in here from Ricky Martin. You've also, though, got a folk song called De Colores. Could you, in such colors, can you describe its significance and give us a taste of it?
This is a song that most Latinos know, have heard when they were little. It's called in Spanish De Colores and in English In Such Colors. And it is about the rainbow that exists in nature and the rainbow that we are as well. De colores se visten los campos en la primavera. In such colors, the countryside dresses itself in spring's graces. De colores son los pájaros que vienen de fuera. De colores es el arco iris que vemos venir. Por eso, los grandes amores de muchos colores me gustan a mí. It's enchanting, great love and its colors, this love that I see.
And that is that splendor of colors, that rainbow of colors. What does that mean? It has a certain political meaning that's pretty well understood in America now. But from a Latino point of view, is that ethnic differences? Is it skin tone differences? Is it background? Is it, you know, point of origin differences?
Yeah, children often
something else, more.
Simplify things, or we mm-hmm. simplify things when we refer to kids. But yes, we have many ethnic and racial tones, and we are different in terms of accents as well. We come from different colors, in different tastes. We dream different dreams, connecting it with magical realism. I wonder, Tom, if different cultures dream different dreams. Nobody, as far as I know, has really done any research into this, but I wonder if the colors of people that come from the Caribbean are different to the colors of people in the Balkans or in China.
It's not all dreamy. There are some real challenges in here as well. There's a reading here from Jose Vasconcelos. I want to tell us about it. It's got a challenge right in it.
Jose Vasconcelos, to me, is one of the most provocative of all essayists. He is from Latin America. He is not from the United States. He was a minister of education, and he wrote an essay. In Mexico. Mm-hmm. He wrote an essay in 1925 called Mestizaje. Mestizo means of mixed blood, and in which he announces, Tom, prophetically, that mestizos will one day dominate the world, that other empires or the races have had their time, and this is what he has to say somewhere in Mestizaje. Mm-hmm. The days of the pure whites, the victors of today, are as numbered as were the days of their predecessors. Having fulfilled their destiny of mechanizing the world, they themselves have set, without knowing it, the basis for a new period, the period of the fusion and mixing of all peoples.
Is that a challenge? Is it simply expectation?
No doubt it's a challenge. I think as you enter the United States today, the country is made of the colores of many colors. Mm-hmm. We have become multicultural, even if we are unhappy. And the tensions that you hear in this country between the group that wants to resist immigration and the group that wants to embrace it is really the tension about how America should be in the future. This anthology, in many ways, contains the DNA of how America looks today and how it would look in the future. You don't have to be Latino to be mestizo. In the United States today, we're all mestizos.
Christina, do these threads ultimately all come together, not just the Latino, but take any Norton collection that you like? Or do they stay separate? Does our culture really meld into one? As we look at this next century, is it separate rivers?
I think it is the new reality. And, you know, and everywhere you look, I mean, it goes both ways, but I think the U.S. is acquiring a bit of a Spanish accent and in large communities, small communities, I read a lot around the U.S., their rapidly growing Latino populations are changing the face and rhythm of life in America. And you know, our sons and daughters are playing on the Little League teams. They're also celebrating their quinceañeras. They're rooting for their favorite contestants on reality shows. In other words, it's not either or. It's not the same sense of, you know, that you had to acculturate by denying your past. I think there's a kind of new model of integration of all the pieces of who you are that I think prefigures the future. And, you know, by 2015, my understanding is that 1 in 5 Americans will consider themselves Latino-Latina, which means we'll pretty much outnumber all other minority groups combined. And I don't know if that we can even use minority anymore with those kinds of numbers and that kind of reality.
2,500 pages here of Latino. Can you foresee, we just got half a minute, Dylan, can you foresee a day when there's one Norton anthology of American literature?
I hope not. I hope we have many anthologies so that people can read many different ways who we are.
Well, to quote from your great tome here, Ricky Martin, Upside Inside Out, we're living la vida loca. It's been, wow. It has been great having both of you with us. Christina Garcia.
Thank you so much.
No, thank you. Author of Dreaming in Cuban and the latest from Christina, The Lady Matador's Hotel. Thank you so much for joining us from Austin, Texas, Christina.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you both.
And Ilan Stabans, great to have you with us.
And
thanks for this great body of work.
My pleasure.
Ilan Stabans, general editor of the Norton Anthology of Latino Literature. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.